Failed Death Saves is a fictional crime podcast set in a homebrew fantasy world. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the writer's imagination or used in a fictitious manner. Any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, or actual events is purely coincidental. It also depicts acts of violence that may not be suitable to all listeners. This is the second part of a three-part series. If you haven't listened to the first part, pause this episode and listen to that one first. In the years between Parthas discovering Illyra's mountain retreat and the destruction of the unnamed town, Parthas had been very busy. It took him a year to uncover everything he could from Illyra's tower. After the long months of repairs and trying to uncover the secrets that were destroyed there, Parthas determined that he needed a new tower. Somewhere closer to civilization, so that he didn't have to travel through the mountains for several days before getting to where he needed to go. One of the things that Parthas learned within the depths of Illyra's tower were several powerful necromancy spells. Over the years, he worked on refining his conjuration magic, but the few devils and demons he tried to summon to help him with rebuilding Illyra's tower were too costly. The things that he wanted done were not done as quickly or as well as he wished, and the more powerful devils were uninterested in dealing with him, or asked for prices that were entirely too high. All of his experiments on conjuration proved to be a disaster and a failure. Parthas decided to get help from the undead instead. The undead were much more tolerable. They could be very easily controlled, and they didn't require any deals or bargaining, and the cost of creating them was much lower. With a small army of skeletons made from the long-dead bodies of unlucky climbers, Parthas packed up all of his belongings and moved south, almost out of the mountains, but still close enough to the rest of Jilkar to be easily accessed. For 2 more years, Parthas did little but study, refine his experiments on the Death Aura, and command his undead to construct a small tower. Parthas felt that having a large, noticeable tower above ground was something that would only encourage and entice people to come by and look into what was happening. After constructing a small, livable area above the mountain, Parthas commanded the undead to dig a vast underground complex for him to do all his wizardry and experiments out of view. In total, it took almost 4 years of research and experimentation for Parthas to build and enchant the first soul-trapping orb. When he had perfected the orb, Parthas dressed up one of his zombies and sent them out on a long trek to find a small town to bury the orb. Parthas expected to bury it and retrieve the orb in a few years to find it full. But he didn't expect to scry upon his magic item and find everyone around it dead. He rushed to get the orb back before anyone else noticed what happened to the town. If someone discovered the dead and the orb, they might put together what was happening, and Parthas would be in a lot of trouble. He had grown in power over the years, but he was not invincible. Still, the power contained within his Death Aura orb was powerful, enough for him to do many great things before he would even need to worry about getting another one. But he had already built several more. He had to do something with them. It was then that Parthas thought about using them as a passive defense system. He had several of his zombies take the orbs out and bury them in the area around his tower complex. Anyone that got close would die, and he would likely be safe from anyone trying to hunt him down or who got too curious about his little tower. He would even have a way of collecting more souls to power his spells and plans. It was a perfect system. It took only a year for Parthas to burn through most of the energy captured within his first death sphere. That wasn't the only problem facing Parthas. He was starting to run into the wall of his own limits. There was only so much that he could do on his own, without new books or a teacher to show him his own blind spots in his learning. It didn't stop him from trying to summon a very powerful devil from the third level of hell to make a deal for knowledge. Parthas wasn't careful enough, and the knowledge he gained was in a book that was written in a dead dialect of the infernal languages of the Hells, a language which none now living know how to read. With this brick wall and his refusal to deal with the devils anymore, Parthas couldn't figure out a way forward. He caught a lucky break when he spotted a large number of people camping out at the crossroads at the foothills of the mountains that he lived in. It was such a large amount of people that he could spot them all the way from his mountain tower. Such a curious thing piqued Parthas's curiosity. What were so many people doing out there? Was some big event happening that he had been immune to because of his isolation? Parthas could not help himself, and he immediately packed a few meager supplies and went down the mountain to investigate. He needed to know what the deal was. Parthas made his way down the mountain. It took him less than a day, which was good because by the time he made it all the way down, the army, for they were all armed and armored, looked ready to move on. He deliberately didn't dress like a powerful wizard, because he knew that if things went wrong, he could defend himself, but even he would be overwhelmed by the numbers. Pretending to be a hermit and using the name of his favorite alias, Parthas asked around from the soldiers what was going on. "What are all of you doing so far out here?" Parthas, under the alias of Burlakor, asked some of the soldiers who were packing up their camp. "What do you, live under a rock?" one of them barked in response. "Not quite. I live in seclusion in the mountains. I was coming down to buy some supplies before returning to my life of isolation." The soldiers snorted and rolled their eyes at the weird hermit. "We're the Royal Army," one of the soldiers answered. They talked slowly and carefully, like they were talking to a particularly stupid child. Burlakor had to bite his tongue to resist showing them just how powerful and better than them he was. "There's a peasant uprising happening, and we've been sent to put it down." "You think it will go quickly?" "Oh yeah, I got a cousin at the Rogar School, and they've been telling me that they outfitted most of their senior mages with battalions. The peasants ain't got nothing to defend against that kind of magic." The soldiers laughed, clearly expecting an easy and quick war. Parthas instantly had ideas. "Well, if you need any medicinal herbs or a guide through the mountains, I humbly offer my services." The soldiers laughed at Parthas once again. "Sure, whatever you say, Burly. We're the Jilkarian army. We're the most well-supplied force on the continent. We're good without your pathetic herbs." It took all of his willpower to not destroy the entire army force there and then. He waited until they packed up and started to move out before he rushed off to return to his home. Parthas had to grab as many supplies and magical items as he could reasonably carry, and maybe a death orb or two, and rushed off to try and find the rebellion. He could not care less about who ran the country. However, his old teachers, the ones that slighted and expelled him, were fighting for the king, so that meant that Parthas would fight for the opposition. Besides, when he carried the rebellion to victory, he could ask for any payment he desired, which he knew they would jump at the chance to pay him by letting him go into the libraries he was forbidden from. He had little use for gold or wealth, which he knew a struggling army of peasants would love to have a powerful wizard without having to pay him. Parthas used as much magical energy as he could to travel the relatively vast distance to Bastion on Ord. Bensum was too far away, and he would stand out a bit too much in a smaller city. The big city would be something he would need to get to in order to find someone who could lead him in the direction of the rebellion. It didn't take Parthas long to find people sympathetic to the rebellion within Bastion on Ord. He found out very quickly that the reigning king, Lovel V, was both dim-witted and a drunkard. The king favored the old noble families of Bensum to the detriment of every other city in Jilkar, and to the detriment of the many guilds and businesses that operated with the royal favor. The tensions had reached a breaking point when Lovel V bailed out the bankrupt Emerald Heart Company, which was a company established by one of the noble families in Bensum, to run as an import-export company with exclusive rights to sell in Bensum. The company barely lasted 5 years, being run so poorly and ineffectively that it was threatening to close and take down at least 3 noble family fortunes. Until Lovel paid off all the debts. All the while, many other companies and families were destroyed by the monopoly of the Emerald Heart Company, and the king did nothing. Parthas found it very hard to listen to the rants and explanations about how terrible Lovel was and how he was personally running Bastion on Ord into the ground, because he did not care 1 ounce about Lovel or the rebellion. He was just going to use them to accomplish his goal. Luckily, with Bastion on Ord being such a hotbed for sympathetic rebellion, it was no problem for Parthas to get an audience with someone powerful in the army to take him on. So contrary to popular rumors and historical misconceptions, Barleycorn did not engineer the war to feed his death aura and his ascension to lichdom. The war against the tyranny of Lovel V was more chaotic than either side reasoned it was going to be. The nobles thought that the destruction of the peasant rebellion would be quick and easy. The rebellion thought that no one in their right mind would defend such a disastrous king. The nobles were organized and well-equipped. The rebels were quick and able to form small militias with unmatched speed. Barleycorn was right. The rebellion eagerly accepted his terms, his magic and aid in the war, in exchange for access to all the magical libraries when they won. He signed up for the war effort using his favorite alias. He didn't want to give anyone who knew him an advantage by knowing his name if they found out he was working with the rebellion. Also, if his old teachers learned he was in the rebellion, their knowledge of him might give them an advantage in spying and scrying on him. Given the options, he wanted to give his enemies as few weapons as possible. Barleycorn joined the war at a most crucial moment. Most of the best fighters and tacticians were overwhelmed and killed by the sheer size of the Jalkarian National Military. When the military also brought in wizards, the rebellion was truly outclassed. They had to break apart into smaller bits to run and hide, only attacking when they saw golden opportunities. With Barleycorn on their side, they had a chance, however slim, to even the playing field a bit. He was not the only mage in the rebellion, but he was far and away the most skilled. The two others were a hedge witch, a self-taught practitioner of a blend of arcane and nature-based magic, and a bard that had failed out of Bard College in Bensum. Despite the small size of the rebellion and the few number of mages in their employ, they managed to win several key battles. This was mostly that because of all the rebellion's mages were unsanctioned, which meant that the spells and tools that they used against the nobles and the nationalists were considered illegal by the other wizards. Notably, the rebellion was very fond of using the undead. Necromancy and the use of the undead in warfare was explicitly banned by the Wizards' Council of Durnadenna in 1183. The council had no real authority, and the guidelines and rules set forth had only been enforced by each wizard agreeing to use the same rules. Since the rebellion was backed by three unsanctioned mages, they never agreed to those terms of warfare. This gave the rebellion an extremely crucial leg up on their enemies. Barleycorn was fond of using the undead, as it was a very low-cost way of enforcing the troops in battle. The undead did not have morale to worry about, they required no additional supplies to reinforce, and their numbers could be instantly replaced by a fallen ally, or enemy. The war was long, bloody, and chaotic. Tracing the movements of Barleycorn and the other mages during the years of rebellion was difficult. The nationalists knew very little about him, as they only had a name and little else, which made Barleycorn extremely hard to spy on. This was helped by the rebels' extreme paranoia, which was expressed in their habit of keeping very little written down as possible. The few things that are known facts about the war against the tyranny of Lovel V and Barleycorn's involvement is that Barleycorn and the other rebellion mages were constantly shuffled around from different battle zones, so that the nationalist forces could never truly predict who they would be fighting against, and that Barleycorn was at the Battle of Burned Ridge. The Battle of Burned Ridge was proving to be a decisive defeat for the rebellion. The nationalist forces managed to summon reinforcements before Barleycorn and the rebels could rout them or retreat. It also didn't help that the enemy wizard was Barleycorn's old teacher, Guland Markteeth. It was likely this old enemy that personally slighted Barleycorn that led him to dangerous tactics that cost him and the rebellion greatly. Guland had managed to corner Barleycorn on top of a small hill. Recognizing the old student and seeking to destroy what was clearly someone on the verge of becoming an evil wizard, Guland almost killed Barleycorn with a well-placed lightning spell. Barleycorn's defenses were drained from both the long battle and the constant movement of the rebellion. He had precious little time to rest and recover, and this battle in particular had drained him even further. In the split second before his end was to reach him, at the hands of that old man Guland, Barleycorn summoned a vast amount of power that he had stored in the death orb he had on him. The souls of all those that died in the way around him was enough to sustain his life despite the extreme damage he suffered from Guland's advanced magic. It should have been Parthas's time. He should have died. Surviving such a blow should have been impossible, but it was done. Surviving the unsurvivable, Berlicor pulled out the last of the soul power from his death orb and unleashed a firestorm that overwhelmed the enemy mage and a large chunk of both armies. The Nationalists suffered the worst losses, and without Gulen to support them with his magic, the rebellion finally defeated the Nationalists, despite heavy losses. The war continued for more than a year after the battle at Burned Ridge. In total, the war lasted for a little more than 2 years and resulted in the deaths of almost 300,000 people. The Nationalist Wizards suffered an extremely high casualty rate, while Berlicor was the only survivor of the rebellion's mages. The war was long, bloody, and came to an abrupt end. Lovel V was the problem at the center of the war, so when he suddenly died, having drank himself to an early grave, the main reason to keep prosecuting the war left just as suddenly. There were plenty of fighters on both sides of the war that wanted to keep fighting to justify their long-held grudges and to punish their enemies. However, fatigue had set in, and there were massive desertions that greatly affected both armies, which did untold damage to the morale of those still fighting. Lovel V was succeeded by his daughter, Foreth I. Foreth was not her father in any way. She was not a drunkard, and while she was a traditionalist and wanted to return to the way things were when they were peaceful and stable, the rebellion found her to be an acceptable ruler. The new queen realized that her father's asinine favoritism of old noble families was threatening to completely undermine Jilkar's economy. It was the bare minimum that the rebellion had been asking for when it started. But combined with other small concessions to the rebellion's leadership and the offer of a general amnesty to anyone who was under arms who ceased fighting, the war was all but over. A general amnesty was not approved of by everyone. Most notably, there were several of the surviving mages that fought for the Nationalists that were against the notion of freedom for Berlicor and the numerous crimes that they claimed he had committed. The laws of Jilkar did not explicitly ban the use of illegal magic done by the rebellion, and they never ratified the decisions of the Durnadenna Council into state law. So no official laws were broken. The queen realized that there was nothing official they could do to sanction or charge Berlicor with, as he had technically broken no laws. He was extremely pleased with this outcome. However, because the war ended in something of a draw, the queen saw no reason to honor the agreement Berlicor had struck with the leaders of the rebellion. His only reward for his services during the war were the scars, memories, and the promise that he would not be arrested for anything done in the war. This enraged Berlicor to no end. Once again, his estranged college was trying to stifle him in every way they could, whether or not they knew they were doing it. However, the former rebellion leaders, having gotten some power and positions in the new order, would do their best to honor their agreements. Berlicor would still be barred from the most prestigious mage libraries in Jilkar and everything in Bensum. The libraries in Bastion on Ord would always be open to the wizard who did so much to help the rebellion and their city. While it would not be the ideal outcome for Berlicor, he decided that he would take the deal such as it was. It would be more knowledge than he would have been able to get his hands on otherwise, and it wasn't worth destroying the few positive connections that he had made. Berlicor was quiet for several years. He was making his way through every single magical text in the entirety of Bastion on Ord. With all of his new knowledge at his fingertips, Berlicor had enough knowledge and skill to refine his death orbs finally. Once he had learned all that he could from the texts within the Bastion on Ord libraries, Berlicor got to work on his next stage. The effects from the war never really left Parthas, as it was extremely hard on lots of people, especially the rebellion mages, who were constantly at the forefront of the fighting, often without breaks or chances to recover. Berlicor had seen some of the worst of the fighting, coming close to dying several times. But his near-death experience at the hands of the hated Gulland stayed with him for the rest of his life. The fact that his mortal body was weak and fragile, and that his death was always just around the corner, was something that caused him great and constant distress. He hated that his mortal body was going to give out at some point before he had a chance to learn everything that there was to learn. After spending many years in the libraries of Bastion on Ord, Parthas managed to vastly increase his arcane knowledge. He was a regular fixture in the libraries, always reading and taking as many books as he possibly could. He devoured many texts on just about every subset of magic. With his new access to knowledge, he managed to refine the death orbs to be much smaller and affect a much smaller radius, so he could keep a few on him and specifically target any person that was within arm's reach. Most importantly, Parthas discovered a way to keep him out of the effects of the death aura. With his knowledge of the allowed magic texts that he was able to read completed, Merlikor retired almost entirely from public life. He had his experiments on the death orbs and soul trapping to do, and that was exactly the kind of thing that he would be executed over. He knew that he could use the magic of the souls trapped within to expand his lifespan under extreme circumstances. The only problem was that he needed a way to have it work automatically, as there was no real way to predict when a terrible accident would befall him and end his life. That was a problem that he could solve at another time. Before he did that, Merlikor had to deal with one final slight. He knew that he couldn't target the Grandmasters of the college that exiled him, or his old war enemies, as those options would put a firm spotlight on him. The one small comfort he had was that he had killed Guland in the war. Instead, Merlikor targeted one of the few remaining bureaucrats at Rogar College. The few teachers who still taught at the college who were responsible for his expulsion and blacklisting were all but untouchable. It was a vexing problem. But eventually, he discovered a solution. Lester Lorkin was the highest-ranking non-wizard in the college, and was an extremely valuable member of the institution, as he was responsible for keeping the bills paid and other mundane non-magical tasks that the Grand Wizards thought beneath them, which made him a very easy target for Merlikor. He planted several small death orbs around Lester's property and waited for the inevitable to happen. After less than a week of the constant bombardment of the death aura, Lester snapped and killed a delivery man. Lester was called to the door to accept a delivery of a few important documents from the college. But instead of accepting them, he stabbed the man on his doorstep 13 times. After realizing what he did, he ran to the basement of his modest house and hung himself. It was a simple matter to collect the hidden death orbs. Then, in an act of petty vengeance, Merlikor targeted the replacement for Lester with the exact same plan. Anyone who tried to take the position to run the college was almost immediately driven insane and killed. The position became something of a curse, and no one would touch it. Even though there is only circumstantial evidence tying Merlikor to the death of two of the people who held the position, it is often surmised that he killed at least six people who worked at the college. There is a not unfounded theory that this lack of bureaucratic oversight and a steady hand guiding the college that led to the eventual closure of the college as a whole. The rest of Julkar moved on, and largely had forgotten about Merlikor, the rebellion wizard, and even less remembered Parthas, the expelled and exiled wizard. The mountains around his lair had started to become known as the Shade Mountains, and had a reputation for resulting in many people going missing, strange deaths, and terrifying creatures haunting the cliffs. Many expeditions were launched to the Shade Mountains over the years to explore and try to find the sources of the death and destruction that lay there, but there was little to find. Very few of those brave adventurers that went to explore the woods returned alive. During the summer of 1402, a dwarven man named Morkel Shaleheart came running into the small town of Two Rivers like he was being chased by death itself. Morkel was known as a local eccentric in the small town. His ideas were always wild and harebrained, which rarely, if ever, panned out for him. Somehow, he had gotten the idea that if he followed one of the very small rivers that gave the town its name to the source in the Shade Mountains, he could pan for gold and precious stones. Like most of his ideas, there was a shred of believability to it, as there had been the occasional fragment of a precious stone or valuable mineral found in the riverbeds. But it also required him to go into the Shade Mountains. Despite the warnings from the other townfolk, Morko was determined to finally find his fortune. When he returned less than 2 days later, he claimed he was being chased by an army of the undead. After giving Morkel several shots of whiskey to calm his nerves, he told his rambling and barely coherent tale. He had gone up into the mountains and started looking for gold. He started digging in the riverbed, trying to uncover something valuable, when he accidentally broke through into an underground tunnel. At first, he thought he found a mythic, forgotten dwarven city, with all the untold riches that it could hold, and immediately went inside. Instead of finding valuables, he found a small horde of zombies that immediately turned to chase him, hungry for the life that he held. Morkel turned tail and ran, fleeing out of the tunnel and out of the mountains. No one in Two Rivers believed him, as he was prone to wild stories and theories. But when Morkel showed off the one valuable thing he did find, the people believed him. Shortly before he was attacked by zombies, Morkel had found a shiny black orb covered in gold wires and runes. It looked extremely valuable, so he grabbed it. It was about the size of his fist and glowed faintly with what looked like little stars inside the black glass-like substance. Morkel was further vindicated when a horde of the undead descended on Two Rivers that night. To be continued. Failed Death Saves was written by Gelatinous Cube Matt Bresnahan and performed by Cube Gelatin Luke Van Marter. You can follow Matt on Twitter at StalkedByTrains and Luke on Instagram at AceMcChips. You can also follow this podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Failed Death Saves Podcast. Like, share, subscribe, leave a review, and remember to roll high.